You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 7th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Cara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
All right, so what happened in the last week that was newsworthy?
Okay.
Not much.
Something about someone came down with something.
Someone or someone's.
The president caught COVID-19, and there was basically a super spreader event at the White House.
Yeah.
And a ton of the people in his orbit also came down with COVID-19.
I think it was 19, Steve, last count?
Last I heard.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Ironical. So it highlights the fact that this pandemic is still ongoing. It's a very infectious agent. You have to be extremely careful. One of the things that came out of this, though, so again, we're not trying to pick on Trump, but you know, this is something we have to talk about. There was a lot of confusion surrounding pretty much everything to do with the president's infection. He went to Walter Reed Hospital, which is a military hospital, and it's where, you know, the president would go when he gets sick. Mm-hmm. And the care that he received there was odd. It's not how a regular person would have been treated. Let me put it that way. There is something, by the way, if I could back up for a second. In medicine, we do refer to what we call VIP medicine, where if you have a very high profile, like VIP patient, sometimes they get special treatment. But the thing is, it's usually not better than standard care.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of VIP care can often be worse because anything that biases the decision making, if you think about it, the clinical decision making should already be optimized to risk versus benefit and all that stuff.
Right.
And anything that biases that is going to deviate from optimal.
It's it could
not
only
going
deviate.
To be good.
That's
now,
right.
The only time where it's better medicine is obviously in the superficialities. I once had I was on service when a Saudi prince, a literal Saudi prince, basically bought the entire floor of the hospital for him to stay. So, yeah, yes, you get that kind of a treatment. But the actual medical care, unless, like, you know, you can't pay for things.
Well, and that's the real problem in our country, right, is that some people are getting not optimal care simply because they can't afford not optimal care.
Right. But to be honest with you, like, if you're sick, you know, most people are getting the care that they need. Insurance is paying for it, or the hospital just does it and worries about getting paid for it later, to be honest with you. And then they are sort of baking into the whole system, taking a certain loss. But
regardless of how you feel about Trump, like, he is the president, which means he needs to be well as soon as possible.
He should be getting the best care. He should be getting the absolute best care that we can deliver. But where the VIP care deviates from optimal is when they do things like give experimental treatments, you know?
Mm-hmm. And they were giving him drugs that usually we only give people when they're critical, right?
So he got one experimental treatment, a monoclonal antibody. He received the remdesivir, which is pretty standard, but again, usually, you know, given in severe cases. But the real curious thing was that he was given steroids. And steroids are usually reserved for people in the later stages, the people who have who get the immune reaction after the first week or so that they're sick. When their immune reaction, like a really negative, harmful immune reaction, kicks in, then we give them steroids to sort of tamp that down. You don't necessarily want to give them that initially because the steroids suppress the immune system, right? It might suppress your ability to fight off the virus early on.
So there's no prophylactic kind of benefit to taking the steroid.
But perhaps he was sicker than they let us on.
Yeah. So there's a mismatch between what we were being told about how he was and what we were being told about what he was getting. And
I tell you, I'll say, when I become a super VIP and I go to the hospital and buy a floor, whatever I do, I will say, give me the standard of care, but add on-demand foot massages. That's my VIP treatment.
That's fine. If that's your VIP treatment, that's fine. But he got steroids. And so
he also got oxygen, right, Steve?
Yeah, oxygen,
like, multiple times.
Yeah, oxygen standard. Your O2 sats drop, you're going to get oxygen.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. Like, maybe he was sicker than we thought, because within the first like, apparently he got oxygen while he was still at the White House before they decided to bring him in. And then the doctor was really cagey about whether or not he was still needing oxygen supplementation.
Yeah, so yes, you're correct. So we're kind of talking about two different things. Mm-hmm. So you're correct in that there's a mismatch between the different things that we're being told.
Right.
When did he contract it? When did he know? When did he become symptomatic? How sick was he? Did he require oxygen? Did he have pneumonia? His doctor's being cagey about all of these things. Mm-hmm. But we did learn that he did, on two occasions was temporarily given supplemental oxygen because his O2 saturations dropped, which means there was some pulmonary involvement. But the steroids is a different issue. I don't think that's a manifestation of him being sicker than we were told, because he would not be out of the hospital now if that were the case. Mm. That's a manifestation, I think, of them throwing everything at him to get him better as quickly as possible, even if it's not necessarily the best thing.
And it could backfire. It could make
horrible.
Him sicker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on behind closed doors, but you just wouldn't give that at this stage of the illness. And I've read multiple articles of COVID-19 treating doctors saying this doesn't make any sense. There's no scenario where he should be getting steroids at this point in his care.
What if he's been sick for a week, Steve?
Well, yeah, you would have to think that. But again, he wouldn't have bounced back that quickly. When you're at the point that you need steroids, you know, you're probably intubated or you're close to being intubated.
And there's no way. I mean, even if he was sick slightly longer than – we all saw him at the debates.
Yeah.
He was enough to – he had a lot of energy that night.
He was not somebody who needed steroids. So again, the only way to make sense of it, in my opinion – is that he was given steroids because that would have made him feel great and made him look good quickly, right?
Right, for his little drive around and then for all the press conferences he was doing.
Yes, but it wasn't necessarily the case.
Yeah, that's reprehensible.
But it wasn't the best medical care.
Super common historically. Presidents, I mean, there are so many articles running around now of like all of the different examples of presidents trying to seem more well than they were for the general public to like instill kind of confidence and faith.
That makes sense. It's common.
I mean, it was even sort of the entire plot of West Wing.
Yeah, it's true.
No spoilers, right?
Yeah.
What I don't understand is this. If they were giving him that medication, because we're not 100% sure about any of this, by the way, we have to question everything that we heard. But if they were giving him that medication at that time, and if the people that were giving him the care knew what they were doing, then they absolutely had to have a reason to give it to him.
Yeah, but it may not have been a good reason. That's what we're saying.
Right.
And also, what do you do? I mean, this is a completely, hypothetical, Steve, but what do you do as a physician who has an ethical directive to first do no harm?
You follow the
Hippocratic Oath. You're doing all of that. And you know what the standard of care is. And then you have somebody who's in an incredible position of power saying, well, my doc says X, and I'd really prefer you give me X.
Morally, ethically, professionally, that's an easy one, right? You do what's appropriate.
But how many people actually would?
I think most doctors would, to be honest with you. But I think Trump has a history of surrounding himself with people who do what he wants, not what's right.
Yeah. And also, there's a difference if something is like contraindicated than if something is like gray area.
Yeah. But also, there's a difference between like the VIP patient refusing something, anybody can refuse anything they don't want, versus demanding something that's not indicated or not appropriate. You can't demand inappropriate or unethical care. And in my opinion, any doctor worth his salt would simply refuse. Say, no, I'm not going to give you the thing that you want because it's not appropriate.
But like you said, steroids, for example, they take down swelling, they open your throat up, they give you a little bit of pep. Like that might be something where maybe it wasn't for his treatment, but for his presentation.
You could say that it's a judgment call and that's in the gray area. But what I'm saying is every physician who has commented on it, in their judgment, it was inappropriate.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Ooh, so what does that tell us then?
Yeah, so I don't know. You could make up your own sort of decision about that. The other thing that came up, and this is one of the things that we've got tremendous number of questions on, is what is the significance of the fact that Trump's personal physician, the guy doing all this, is a D.O.
Is an osteopath?
Yeah, doctor of osteopathic medicine rather than an M.D. So his personal physician, Sean Conley, who I think, throughout this episode was, again, inappropriately cagey and not forthcoming with information, and claiming privacy pretty much on a whim at random, you know, not consistently. Yeah. Just like whenever he didn't want to answer a question, he would say, oh, that's private. But then he would give equivalent information if he wanted to give it. So it was very inconsistent. But in any case, the question is, is there anything significant about the fact that this guy's a DO rather than MD? So it's a little complicated. I wrote about it on Science-Based Medicine today. If you want to do a deep dive on that, you could read that article. And then we'll link to that in the show notes. But here's the very quick version is that, you know, 100 plus 120, 130 years ago, osteopathic medicine was basically in the same at the same level as chiropractic medicine. It was a vitalistic, completely pseudoscientifically based, you know, alternative form of medicine based on the notion that if you manipulate the bones and the neuromuscular system that you could, you know, life energy will heal anything, right? The same basic idea as chiropractic, except, you know, osteopaths thought the life energy was in the bones and the fascia, and chiropractors think it's in the nerves, right? So otherwise, pretty much the same. But when the Flexner Report came out and American medical schools were sort of, were really...
regulated?
Reforming themselves and really becoming science-based for the first time. Both osteopathic medicine and chiropractic medicine, they were sort of given the option of, now's a good time to come on board to this whole science-based medicine thing. And chiropractors said, nerds, you know, then they went their own way. Mm-hmm. And the osteopath said, sure, we will adhere to the science-based standards that medical schools do. And so since that time, basically, their education has been largely equivalent to MDs.
They get the same minimum basic standards.
Yes. But the big difference is they also learn osteopathic manipulation, which is pure pseudoscience. It's like going to medical school and then learning chiropractic manipulation on top of all of it. You know what I mean?
They might see like an allopathic, as they would call it, or like a regular doctor as somebody who only treats the disease or just the symptoms, whereas they kind of tout themselves, osteopaths, as people who look at the body holistically and they treat the person, not the disease, which is like bullshit rhetoric.
Yes,
right?
So this is what happened. So for a time, it was basically just medicine plus osteopathic manipulation. Then when the whole alternative medicine BS happened, they basically retconned themselves to say, oh, yeah, that's right. We're into holistic preventive medicine. Mm-hmm. That's what osteopathic medicine is all about. That's the difference between us and, you know, allopathic doctors. But that's BS.
Yeah, because doctors want to prevent disease too.
Yeah, it's just retconning of osteopathic medicine. It is that has nothing to do with that. It was about vitalism and pseudoscience, not about whatever you think holistic means and preventive medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's just modern marketing, to be honest with you. Now, in reality, DOs, many of them go to the same internships and residencies as MDs. And quite honestly, that's when you learn all the stuff that you actually practice anyway. So they're essentially equivalent to MDs. And also,
and he was a naval guy, I think. He trained at a military a military medical center.
I don't know if that matters. But
and did some VA stuff. Yeah, and then he was like in Afghanistan. So I think he's mostly been kind of that line of medicine.
Yeah, but more importantly, you know, over the years, the osteopaths are doing less and less osteopathic manipulation. It's basically fading away.
Mm.
And so eventually, I don't think there really is going to be any difference between DOs and MDs. So, you know, and in my experience, there's no difference.
Right. Licensed doctors.
Yeah,
they're physicians.
They're licensed doctors. Exactly. Yeah. The only difference is some may still cling to, you know, osteopathic manipulation as a marketing alternative thing. And they shouldn't. They should really just get rid of it as a profession.
Right.
But that's sort of their roots, their culture, you know, their identity, but they should get rid of it.
Huh.
But so anyway, like that's a very frequent question that we get because almost nobody knows what's the difference between a DO.
Now,
and
a naturopath.
Naturopath's totally different animal. They're pure pseudoscience.
Beware the naturopath. Yeah.
Also, this guy was a big supporter of hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah.
I was half expecting Trump to want to take a dose of that and then go touting the benefits of it. But
no, of course not, because it's like when push comes to shove, he wants the real shit.
Well, right.
That's right. This is how it always happens.
When the homeopaths get sick, you know, the purveyors of the crap, then they go to the real doctor to get, it's the biggest hypocrisy
ever. It's so transparent. It's utterly pathetic that they didn't even mention the medication.
Well, I think what's more frustrating for this really, like, you know, take out all of our emotional reactions and all of our questions about his physician. The response when he left and kind of the line that Trump has been utilizing since then was, don't be too afraid of this thing. Look, I'm okay, which is insulting to the over 200,000 people who have died of this disease. Mm. And also very bad public health messaging.
Very bad.
It's scary. Like, he was probably very sick and might still be very sick. And yet he's sitting here saying, guys, it's, you know, don't let it run your life. It's not that scary. It's like, oof.
All right. Well, that was the big COVID-19 update in the last week. Oh, but meanwhile, meanwhile, the pandemic is chugging along in the United States, definitely. And to render, you know, look globally, if you look at the global numbers,
they're
over 210,000 deaths in the United States. Over 7 million cases, and the numbers are really not going down. They're kind of still plateauing at a pretty high level.
I think they're going up in something like half of U.S. states right now.
Yeah.
It's like we're seeing another big drive. Ugh. Yeah, it's rough.
Yeah, it's rough. Okay, so we'll keep tracking the story as we have been throughout the whole pandemic. Before we get to the news items, we have some sad news, actually. Scott Lilienfeld, who is a renowned skeptic, psychologist at Emory University, died last week of, I found out it was of pancreatic cancer. So he did have a chronic illness.
Oh,
didn't know about that. That was actually quite a shock. So I've worked with Scott. You know, he's been at Nexus. We worked together a little bit on CSI and their medical endeavors. And he wrote, you know, a couple articles for Science-Based Medicine, et cetera. So fantastic guy. He was an absolutely fantastic guy. And if you read, you know, the stories about him after his passing, that's like the one thing that everyone wants to say. He was like the best teacher, the, you know, the most humanity of anyone I've ever known. And he also was, you know, I respected him greatly because he was one of these professionals who was able to very, very seamlessly mix together, more traditional science and, and skeptical. Activism,
right?
Skepticism.
Yeah, he brought them together, definitely.
Yeah, he did in a very good way.
Yeah,
and also science communication. Like, he was publishing in, you know, professional and sometimes kind of esoteric journals, but he was often writing write arounds of the research that he did for public consumption. And most students of psychology know his name because, or academic psychologists, they know his name because they're reading his work. Interestingly and weirdly, so last week, if you guys remember, I didn't have a news item, and that's because I had prepared a news item based on a recent publication of Dr. Lilienfeld and his colleagues about
conspiracy thinking.
Yes, conspiracy theories and kind of what personality traits and maybe some psychopathology that's correlated with that. And as I was about to get into it, we were like, you know what, we should reach out to him and see if he wants to talk about this on the show. Obviously, we've had him on before. We should just call him. And so let's skip doing this story and let's see if he can come speak. And then that night, or maybe it was the very next morning, we heard of his death.
Yeah, the next day.
Jeez. It was really intense. It was like, wow, we had like a line out to him. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I think it was just one of those things where it wasn't really public knowledge. And
yeah, I had no idea.
Yeah. And then it just happened quickly. And people are seeing that. I mean, Van Halen just died. And it was the same kind of thing. He had been battling cancer for quite some time.
Oh, long time, but throat cancer.
Yeah, but he turned quickly. Very quickly. Mm-hmm.
They said it spread throughout his body so fast, went to his brain and other areas in a matter of days. It was insane.
Yeah. All right. Well, Scott will be missed. You know, if you're not familiar with his work, you know, look it up. He's a great skeptic, great psychologist, great science communicator, and just a great human being. Oh. All right. Let's move on to the news items. It is Nobel Prize Week. So we have the three Nobel Prizes in science to talk about. I'm actually going to start with the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. And this is awarded to three scientists who were instrumental in the discovery of hepatitis C. Yeah, so the prize is shared evenly between Harvey Alter, Michael Houghton, and Charles Rice. Hepatitis C is one of three viruses that cause liver disease, liver inflammation. Hepatitis A and hepatitis B were discovered first. Hepatitis A is a food-borne and stool-borne illness. Hepatitis B is blood-borne. And when hepatitis B was discovered, that accounted for many of the transfusion-induced hepatitis illness, right? So people would get a blood transfusion, they would come down with hepatitis. It was discovered that, yes, some of these people have a virus that was discovered that became hepatitis B. But there was still a large group of people who were getting post-transfusion non-A, non-B hepatitis, right? And so the idea was, well, there's got to be, or maybe, you know, it's, who knows what it is, but there may be, there's another virus out there causing, blood-borne virus causing hepatitis. So the discovery started with Harvey Alter. What he demonstrated was that blood from patients who had this non-A, non-B hepatitis can be transferred with a blood through the blood. And essentially, they gave it to chimpanzees, who are the only other species known to be susceptible to this. So if you take blood from a human with this mystery hepatitis, you give it to a chimpanzee, then they get hepatitis. So that shows that it's a contagious agent. It's an infectious agent. And then Michael Houghton discovered that there were RNA viral particles that correlated with that, and then eventually identified that as part of the flavivirus family, not to be confused with the flavivirus family. And then Charles Rice, he had to demonstrate, to close this loop, to prove that they discovered the virus that was causing this, he had to show that if you took just that virus and transferred it to a chimpanzee, that they would get, now, so not the blood, not the blood from an infected person, but if you just took an isolated piece of that RNA virus and gave it to a chimpanzee, they would get hepatitis. And that's what he demonstrated. So that was, they identified the virus, they proved that it caused hepatitis C, they proved that it by itself, without anything else, can be transferred and can cause hepatitis C. So the three together, you know, took the steps necessary to discover the hepatitis C virus. This is a big deal. This is actually a big deal. This is the kind of thing that we take for granted now. But imagine if every time you needed a blood transfusion, you had to, you know, spin the wheel and you might come down with a chronic hepatitis that can cause a liver failure or liver cancer down the road. The estimate is that they've saved millions of lives with this discovery. So first, we can screen hepatitis C out of the blood supply. That's nice. So you don't get it with a blood transfusion. And this led to research, which eventually led to effective antiviral drugs. So there's drug treatment for hepatitis C. And there's a global effort underway to eradicate hepatitis C. Now, we've mentioned before that you can only eradicate diseases that have no non-human reservoirs or vectors. This one does, but chimpanzees is such a small population. We still might be able to eradicate it, even though chimpanzees are also susceptible.
Right. Well, and they're so threatened too. There's not that many left in the wild, right. And they're confined only to like two or three countries in Africa.
Yeah.
So,
plus, it's a bloodborne illness, right?
Right. So, you'd have to either eat a chimp or be working with chimp carcasses or something. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Or be attacked.
Steve, when did this work take place? How long ago was this research done?
Starting in the late 1970s.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and then through the 1980s, took about a decade. You know, when I graduated medical school in 1991, we already knew about hepatitis C at that point. So to me, it was old hat. But yeah, but it was, the relevant papers were published mainly in the 1970s and into the 1980s.
Well, finally getting the recognition they deserve then.
Yeah. But this is not an unusual delay for the Nobel Committee.
No, a generation, that's about right.
Yeah, but definitely deserving. Okay, Bob, you're going to tell us about the Nobel Prize in Physics.
So, yes, this year, three people shared my favorite Nobel Prize for physics, of course. Did you know that physics was the first Nobel Prize to be listed when Alfred Nobel described the fund in his will? Just saying. Roger Penrose, Reinhard Genzel, and Andrea Ghez all share the Nobel Prizes for Physics this year for, as the Nobel Committee described it, for work that has helped reveal the darkest secrets of the universe. So I'll start with Penrose. Roger received a half share of the Physics Prize for his work showing that black holes flow directly and strongly from Einstein's general theory of relativity.
Yeah.
And you may say, no duh, black holes. You know, it's easy to take black holes for granted. Nobody really doubts their existence. And sure, the minute details are argued back and forth, just like for evolution or even gravity. But the broad strokes for the existence of black holes is basically never doubted these days. But if you go back even a few decades, many scientists thought that, you know, that they weren't real things. You know, even though general relativity predicted black holes, that doesn't necessarily mean that, yes, they must exist if it predicts it. They believe that for the universe to actually produce them, it would require these amazingly idealized scenarios and perfect symmetries that would never come about in the real universe. And by the way, even Einstein didn't believe in black holes. So it's not a strange thing that it took this seminal paper by Penrose to actually turn these things around. So he changed, this happened in 1965 with his paper, Gravitational Collapse and Space-Time Singularities. In it, he used some new ingenious, as they've been described, mathematical tools that he brought to bear on black holes, specifically topology, which was his specialty. Topology describes what happens essentially to geometric shapes as they're stretched and morphed. So he said the following about his amazing discovery. He said, "I had general arguments which were pure mathematical, topological arguments, not the kind of thing people were using. And it was this idea, which I call the trapped surface, which is a characterization of when your collapse had reached a point of no return. Roughly speaking, it didn't depend on symmetry or anything like that. It was just a general characterization that could tell you that something has gone funny." So what he's saying there is that he discovered mathematically that black holes did not require some impossibly specific scenario to form. They just flowed simply and easily from general relativity. You know, just throw enough mass together and you will get a black hole. That's it. You don't need any other crazy scenarios in order for that to happen. And this is what he was saying. So the implication then was basically, hey, guys, go out and look for black holes because they're out there and you will probably find them. And that's exactly what we did, right? The last, you know, all the years since 1965. So, you know, and I was thinking, what a testament to his paper that today, not only have we seen countless black holes by their obvious gravitational influence in the universe, but also, you know, we're hearing them smash together in the past handful of years. We're hearing them smash together and using gravitational wave astronomy. And we even saw one directly using radio telescopes just last year. So that, you know, he really deserves this. And the only thing I would add is that I wish that Stephen Hawking were alive, because I think he would definitely be in the mix here. I think he definitely would be here. You know, for some of these black hole discoveries that are being awarded the prize. But you know, but it's only for people that are still alive. So
and this is Penrose's first Nobel, and he's 89.
Yeah, I think it's his first. But this guy's made some amazing contributions though. So now Reinhard Genzel and Andrea Ghez, I think that's how you pronounce her name, received the other half of the prize for their work that a supermassive black hole does very likely exist at the center of our very own Milky Way galaxy. Now, it's been years that we've known that there was something mysterious going on in the core of our galaxy through some of the radio signals we were getting. Something was there, but to show that, hey, this is a supermassive black hole, even though it may seem obvious, it takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of time to really dot all those I's and cross all those T's. Dr. Ghez, in fact, said, "You need 20 years of data just to get a seat at this table." She's been doing this since 1995. So yes, this is not something that you do, you know, in a few years. This is something, at least with current technology, that takes a lot of time to build up the kind of detail that you need in order to make a compelling argument. So now to get at that table, what they did was they painstakingly tracked the orbits of the closest things that are in orbit, that appear to be in orbit around that invisible something in the center of our galaxy. And what they looked at was, you know, what was there? Stars and globs of gas, essentially. So for example, so in order for a star near the center of the galaxy that they identified to be yanked around its egg-shaped orbit at 5,000 miles per second, or in order for gas to orbit every 45 minutes at 30% the speed of light, there needs to be something very special there, something that seems to have 4 million solar masses at the center, making all that happen, making the stars and the gas behave as they do, something huge, invisible, with a lot of mass. And that something is our supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A star. The Swedish Academy of Sciences said in its announcement Their pioneering work has given us the most convincing evidence yet of a supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. So congratulations to these guys. So also I'll mention that Dr. Ghez is only the fourth woman to win the Nobel Prize in physics, following Marie Curie in 03, Maria Gebhard-Mayer in 63, and Donna Strickland in 2018. She is also one of the authors of the children's book, You Can Be a Woman Astronomer, which I now want to get for Jay's daughter, Olivia. So cool. she'll be seeing that for Christmas, probably, Jay. So yeah, congratulations and very interesting, well-deserved Nobel Prize this year for physics.
All right, Kara, this next one's really exciting.
This one is really exciting. It's really exciting for a lot of reasons. Yeah. It's exciting because this is a topic we talk about all the time on the show because it is absolutely world-changing, and that is the CRISPR-Cas9 system.
Oh, yeah.
It's also exciting because it's the first time ever that the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was split between two women.
Sweet.
Awesome.
Yeah. So get this. In chemistry, 112 different Nobel Prizes have been awarded to 186 laureates because, of course, you know, the awards can be split up to three ways. So 112 prizes, 186 laureates, and the two women who won this year are only the sixth and seventh women in the history of the prize to win.
It's ridiculous. And,
yeah, and the first time it's ever been split by only two women. So the two women are Jennifer Doudna from UC Berkeley, and I worked on how to pronounce her name. It's going to be bad still, though. Emmanuel Charpentier, something like that.
Sounds from, amazing.
Yeah, Charpentier, who is affiliated with the Max Planck Institute for the Science of Pathogens in Berlin, but she is, of course, French. And the title is, quote, "For the Development of a Method for Genome Editing." So we've talked about CRISPR-Cas9. I don't know if I want to do the deepest of dives into that today, but one thing I can tell you is kind of a little bit of the story of how these two women were selected, or at least what their contributions were to this technology, because the interesting thing about CRISPR-Cas9 is that lots of different labs work on this. And even at the beginning, there has been like a turf war between MIT and Harvard and UC Berkeley in terms of patents. There's still actually some legal stuff that's going on in terms of, you know, who gets the patent for what. There are at least three to four other individuals who it's very likely were in the runnings even for a CRISPR-Cas9 Nobel. So, you know, the selection process of who is the discoverer is a hard question when everything's so collaborative now. Some of the statements that I've read from some of the other individuals who worked pretty diligently on CRISPR-Cas9 at the beginning is that they may have worked on making the technology where it is today, but the people who ultimately discovered that CRISPR as a function of a bacterial cell could then be utilized in order to do gene editing. So this natural thing that occurs in bacteria could then be understood and used to our advantage. That really does kind of sit squarely with Emmanuel Charpentier. So the story, it's really interesting. So the story goes, she was, you know, working on what she was working on, and she stumbled across the utility, really, of the CRISPR system. So CRISPR was first named, actually, I want to say in 2000 or like in the early 2000s. It might actually have been as late as the end of the first decade of the 2000s. And do you guys remember what CRISPR stands for? It's okay if you don't. It's really hard to remember.
I used to know it. Yeah. God damn it.
It's hard to remember. Clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats.
Yes, you were right.
Palindromic. That's the word.
Palindromic. And so that's because researchers they were looking at the genome. They were looking at the actual DNA of prokaryotes, which are like the simpler single kind of naked circle DNA holding organism. So usually these are going to be bacteria.
Archaea.
Like these more simple, they don't really have organelles, or they only have like free floating ribosomes. And so they're looking at this DNA, and they've known for some time, like there are these weird repeating parts within their DNA that we don't really know what they code for. So it wasn't like a brand new thing. What is this CRISPR? It's that it was kind of like, what is that? I don't know. It's not really relevant to my work. I've noticed it. Maybe it's been published a couple of times, that nobody really knew what they were, what to do about them. And then in Charpentier's research, she is realizing that, okay, not only are there are these like repetitive portions of the DNA, which is what we actually call the CRISPR system, but there's also this RNA molecule that seems to recognize regions. And so what's going on here? And it looks like, and she actually published in 2011, this first paper that said, huh, it's looking like these palindromic repeats are actually old viral DNA. And so what the bacteria seems to be doing is that when it's invaded by a virus, it's cutting up that viral DNA, and it's actually inserting some of it into its DNA, even though the virus is not infecting it. It's taking some of that viral DNA, inserting these repeats into its own DNA so that it then can recognize them the next time it is potentially infected. So it seemed like it was kind of like an archive of viral DNA. But what she realized is that they also had this RNA molecule that could recognize the sequences. And that was like the light bulb moment. So then she starts up a collaboration with Jennifer Doudna. So Jennifer Doudna knows nothing about CRISPR-Cas9, but she is like a whiz when it comes to RNA molecules and how they translate to proteins and what exactly they do. And so she was like, I'm seeing this thing. It seems like it could be useful. Let's work together to make this happen. So the big paper came out in 2012. That was the paper in Science where they had isolated the major components of the CRISPR-Cas9 system and then adapted them to be able to program it and cut DNA at very specific points that were chosen by the researcher. So again, if you think about CRISPR-Cas9, really what it is it's something that's naturally occurring. They used a streptococcus bacterium where they found these repeated sequences, these CRISPRs, right? And then they said, okay, look, there's this Cas9, which is, it's a protein that the CRISPR RNA is producing that can cut. It's the molecular scissor, the Cas9 protein. It can cut the complex at a very specific location. It already knows how to do this naturally. Let's work together to figure out how to tell it to do it at a very specific point in the DNA. And when they were able to master that, that changed everything. And so that was the big 2012 paper. And that's why the Nobel Committee, I think, really ultimately decided that these two women, although lots of people have worked on this, they were the quote unquote discoverers of the technology.
Yeah, they deserve it.
Yeah, and everything came from there. And it's it's just a really cool story. Again, like, I've had problems with the Nobels for a very long time. Even modern Nobels feel like they hearken from a time that is very old, like it's a white man's club. It in no way is reflective of the scientists, even though we have limits, right? Even though we're struggling with representation within the sciences, the Nobels are that much worse. Like, they're not even reflective of the lack of representation in the sciences. There's like a lack of a representation. So I do know that they have put out statements that they are considering diversity as part of the selection process, that they want to make sure that they're seeing more voices that are involved and not sticking with the old guard. I think part of the problem is that we don't have transparency into how the nominations work, right? They can't be released for 50 years. So what ends up happening when you have kind of an in-group that's nominating each other is that you have certain types of people that get nominated over and over. And so it's really cool to see that that bubble is starting to spread. There's some great interviews with Dr. Doudna. With Emmanuel Charpentier, there had been some, I think, whispers like, you're going to get a Nobel Prize, or this research is Nobel worthy. And she's like, whatever. And usually it doesn't happen this fast either. Remember, it's only like 8 years ago that they published on this. That's a huge turnaround. It's really quick. So both of these women are young. They're in their 50s. But I think that there were mutterings.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, especially for, especially as far as Nobels go. And so I think part of her in the back of her mind knew that it was a chance, but she was still surprised. But Jennifer Doudna, I think, had no idea. Like, it's really cute when you read some of the interviews when they called her and it was like the middle of the night. And she was like, wait, what? What? Like, she just had no clue. And how exciting is that as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's CRISPR. It was inevitable. It's, you know, if not this year, it would have been within 5 years for sure.
See, I would have thought it would have been like way later. Like, because it is huge. You're right. It's massive. And it changed genetic engineering for forever. And like, there's not a lab that this research doesn't touch. There's not an area of biochemistry that this research doesn't touch. Obviously, it's also opened up a lot of controversies. And we've had those conversations on the show about the Chinese scientists who gene edited the twins, and then everybody's like, what are you doing? And now there's, you know, the big committee basically said, this is not ready for prime time. Like, we can't do this in human beings yet. We're not there yet. We've got to stick with lab animals and stick with like in vitro work. But that said, all labs are, I mean, disease eradication, vaccine development. I mean, there's kind of nothing you can't point to that this doesn't help with.
It's, yeah, some things are just too obvious and too obviously worthy in my mind. Here's another example that was even quicker. Gravitational waves.
Exactly. That was really
fast. Astronomy. I mean, the first big discovery was 2015. Then when did they get the Nobel? 2 years later.
Yep,
2 years.
You're right. That was really fast.
That was the kind of stuff that's just like too obvious.
I often liken CRISPR-Cas9 from kind of an impact perspective to PCR, polymerase chain reaction, because it like changed, you know, biology.
Monoclonal antibodies, which got it recently.
Right, or monoclonal. Yeah. But I wonder if CRISPR-Cas9 in the very, you know, years and years down the line, if we're going to see that it actually had an even greater impact.
I mean, it's hard to say, but...
Yeah, it's kind of like gravitational waves.
We're in the early,
still in the relatively early
stages of this technology. It will be so much better in the future.
Oh my God, dude. 10, 15, 20 years? Forget it.
PCR is amazing because you can't really do anything without it. It's like, it used to be such a pain in the ass to do any work with DNA, but now you got PCR. So it's like, you got a tiny sample, got tons of DNA. Hey. It doesn't matter. You amplified it. But it's like one of those precursor things, whereas this is actually the technology required to change. And that's what we're looking at.
Yeah. And it's a technology that not only has practical applications, it is a technology that increases the rate of research itself.
Yeah. And makes it cheaper, makes it more efficient, everything. It's more in within
impact.
Reach. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the most exciting and impactful discoveries, I think, in decades. I mean, this is like a top three of all time kind of scenario, I say.
So congrats to these two amazing women.
Yep, absolutely. All right, just two other news items, non-Nobel news items. Jay, this is a very interesting item. I really have had a hard time wrapping my head around it. So the claim is that researchers have made a circuit that creates limitless energy, limitless power.
Uh-oh.
Red flag. What's going on here?
As I explain this, keep in mind, there are things about this that I significantly don't understand. There are things about the way electricity works that I found out that I still don't have a really liquid understanding of. So I'm going to give you my best explanation. And maybe, Steve, you understand. There was a couple of terms that they use when describing what they came up with here that I still can't wrap my head around.
So, yeah, I mean, I was able to get the original paper and I read that and I don't understand it. I think I got the critical bit of this paper, but I'm not sure exactly what it means. So this is one. We're talking about this largely because so many people asked us about it. But honestly, what we're going to be talking about tonight is a precursor to finding somebody who's an expert who can tell us what it really is.
Right. So let me just give you. Let's go through the lame.
I've been trying as well, Jay. This is a tough one.
The author of the paper will contact us next week.
Absolutely, do it.
Let's go through the layman's term as best we can. I'm going to give you the best description that I can. And before I start, I'm going to say that if this proves out, if their research actually takes this to reality, this is a big deal. So a research team led by Paul Thabato, he's a professor of physics and lead researcher at the University of Arkansas. He published a paper in the journal Physical Review E, and in it, they explain how they developed a circuit that can generate electricity by capturing graphene's thermal motion. Graphene is a two-dimensional sheet of carbon atoms where the carbon atoms are shaped into hexagonal lattice, right? So when you look at this, when you look at a sheet of graphene, it is a one-atom thick, two-dimensional object that is basically a hexagonal grid, right? Can you say that? Can you say hexagonal grid? It's basically
chicken wire.
Yeah, it's like chicken wire made out of atoms. So it's very, 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 very thin, right? And that's important here. They call it an energy harvesting circuit. So this circuit captures energy from graphene, and graphene is a nanometer-sized rippling and buckling effect, right? So if you look at, if you visualize a sheet of this incredibly thin sheet of graphene, which is carbon that is in the shape, carbon atoms that are in the shape, like I said, in a hexagonal shape, right? So just a repeating thing like chicken wire. That sheet actually ripples a little bit and buckles a little bit all the time. And the scientists are not 100% sure why the sheet like subtly rises and falls. They've come up with an idea that the subatomic particles, there are subatomic particles that interact with the graphene itself, and that's what's pushing and pulling it.
Like a type of Brownian motion.
Right.
Yeah, type of Brownian motion.
So they found that at room temperature, graphene's thermal motion induces an alternating current. Now, this is what I just said is important. We're saying that graphene's thermal motion, right? So the thermal motion is the movement of graphene. They're saying that when graphene is pushed and pulled, which in its normal room temperature state, it does it all the time, it actually creates alternating current. So the researchers discovered that.
Can we say at this point, though, Jay,
yeah,
that Richard Feynman predicted this is impossible?
Oh, right. Essentially,
this is Brownian motion, which is just sort of the random Kara, the stochastic motion, right? Word of the week, stochastic. Remember that one? Stochastic motion of things due based upon ambient heat, and you're not supposed to be able to do work, get work or power or energy out of that motion. And Feynman, he claimed that demonstrated that it's basically impossible for Brownian motion to do work.
Right, because the heat itself is the only thing that's leading it to move. The energy is just
this sort of background uniform temperature without any temperature difference.
Well, but they handled that. They proved out the physics to handle that problem. So I can accept if Richard Feynman didn't have enough information at the time or, you know, made a miscalculation. So what? You know, he gave the best information. He gave the best prediction that he could with the information that he had. But this, from what I read, again, you know, from what I read, it sounds like that they had come up with a way that this actually can be a place to harvest energy. So let me give you a little bit more technical information that I found to be really interesting. So they discovered that if they use two diodes in the circuit, that is the key. So a diode is a semiconductor device that allows current to flow easily in one direction, but severely restricts the current flowing in the opposite direction, right? It's like a gate that only allows things to go through it in one direction. So using two diodes, they can convert the original alternating current from the graphene sheet into a direct current. Now, and this is a big part of this research, converting the alternating current into a direct current means that that it could do work. And that there isn't a temperature, there isn't a heat exchange. There doesn't have to be a heat exchange. They're actually getting electricity to push, which could be, when I say push, meaning they could potentially store that energy. They can potentially have that energy go and do something like power a device, a very, very small device, but it's a device, right?
Yeah. So in technical language, I think that they say that it does work, right?
Right.
It can do work.
So the researchers used a new field of physics called stochastic thermodynamics to prove that diodes increase the circuit's power. Now, this was the second shoe of this research was that the diodes, because diodes let energy move in one direction as they pass through them, they can't go back. The diodes actually increase the circuit's power, and that was critical because without the diodes, they couldn't get the power to become DC. And without it being DC, it really can't do anything. right? It can't charge something. Apparently, this is what they say. So they describe the relationship between the graphene and the circuit itself that they're going to build as a symbiotic relationship. Heat does not flow between them. Therefore, none of the concepts that they've come up with contradict the second law of thermodynamics. And that is specifically what Feynman was talking about, is that you cannot break the second law of thermodynamics and capture energy from Brownian motion. Okay.
Or more specifically, Jay, you can't extract work from something that where there's no temperature differential, there's no temperature gradient.
That's in thermodynamic equilibrium.
Right.
Right. If that's what their claim is, and I think there's some controversy over exactly what the specific claim is, then they are breaking the second law of thermodynamics, and this is a huge deal, and they would need extraordinary evidence.
Yep.
If there is some temperature differential that they are exploiting, then that's tried and true. I mean, that's how you get work done.
Yeah.
And that's what makes the heat death of the universe so staggeringly horrible, is that you can't do any work, you can't live, you can't do anything because there's no temperature gradient. Therefore, you can't do any work. Therefore, nothing can exist. So if they could do that,
go ahead, Steve.
That's been done. That's been done before, and it's not nearly as much of a huge deal.
Can I jump to the magic phrase in the actual publication?
Limitless power,
magic.
Baby.
not peer reviewed.
No, in the archive. Yeah.
Here's what they say. Our model provides a rigorous demonstration that continuous thermal power can be supplied by a Brownian particle at a single temperature while in thermodynamic equilibrium, provided the same amount of power is continuously dissipated in a resistor.
Wait, what?
I think that sentence is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
Yes.
Yeah, what does it mean that the same amount of power is continuously dissipated in a resistor? Where is that power coming from that's being dissipated in a resistor? In another section, they say it has to be in a heat bath.
Yep. I saw that phrase a lot, too.
So that means they're inducing a temperature gradient.
So I don't know. So right. I want to know, like, where's the actual energy coming from? So, like, for me, the idea that this can harvest a teeny tiny amount of electricity from the environment, from some subtle source of energy in the environment, that's fine.
Yeah, it doesn't seem crazy.
It doesn't seem crazy, but I just have to know where the energy is coming from. And that's as close as I could get, that sentence. But I don't know what that means, that the power is being dissipated in a resistor. And where's that power coming from? So I tried to find experts talking about it. There isn't that much written about it yet, but some people were saying it's similar to stochastic interference, where you can increase the signal to noise ratio by adding white noise.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's what they're doing, is like this dissipating power in a resistor is adding white noise. If so, they're putting in the power.
Yeah.
That's just being
that's
converted
the energy.
To.
Oops.
So that So I wonder if that's happening. If I'm misunderstanding that, if that's not the case and it's just harvesting it from ambient energy somewhere, that's fine. Doesn't really matter where it comes from. If all you need is a teeny tiny bit of energy. But here's the key. This is sort of a proof of concept. They didn't actually build one of these.
Right. Oh, it doesn't exist yet.
So this is just a
yeah. They drew it. They drew out the circuit. That is the novel thing here, is that they actually created a circuit that they think can pull the energy. But
next step is testing some way.
Let me say a couple of things. This article and the discussion that we're having and the response that we're having to it, to me, is skepticism. In a nutshell, it's science and skepticism in a nutshell. It's a really provocative news item. It's right on the cusp of average people being able to understand it, right? It's beyond basic people, regular people like us who aren't experts in the field. And so that's where the danger is. But the wonderful thing about this is that it's going to be peer reviewed. The truth will come out. And if it works, science has done something magnificent. And if it doesn't work, science has done something magnificent, right?
Yeah.
Like, I just love I love this, because I don't feel like there's any malfeasance in these researchers at all.
No.
I think that they're trying very hard and they're legit. And if their science proves them wrong, they're done and they admit it. You know, this isn't someone selling a free energy machine.
Right, yeah.
Why does the title of this news item read "Physicist Build Circuit That Generates Clean Limitless Power from Graphene"?
Because
that's the press release.
The
that's the press release. That's the press release. It's not the paper.
Yeah, that's awful. They built it in their minds.
Their plan is to build an actual computer chip, right? A chip that has multiple of these circuits on it, and connect that to a capacitor, and then use them to charge the capacitor, and then the capacitor could function a device, right?
Right.
And they said they could do that in about a year. So great, do it. If it's real, it'll work. And if there's something wrong going on here, it won't work. And that's when we'll know. That's like with all of these energy devices, whether it's free energy or subtle energy or whatever, it's always, yeah, build it and run something off of it, and then come talk to me. Until then, you know, we've been here countless times before.
Oh my
but
gosh.
Again, there's lots of we've discussed many news items that where about harvesting really slight tiny pieces of energy from the environment to power pacemakers or other devices that require only teeny tiny amounts of power, but continuous power without being recharged, et cetera. So there may be an application for this. You know, even if the energy is not coming from where they think it's coming from, it still may result in a usable piece of technology. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see. We'll see. This is definitely one that we'll remember, you know, to look back in a year or two years and see if this panned out or if this was just another blind alleyway.
Yep.
But yeah, the process of science will work itself out. All right, Evan, we're going to end with a bit of a lighthearted item. Tell us about Ouija board fear-mongering.
Yeah, let's talk about that. And we'll do so in the context of the Nobel Prize, because the Nobel Prize for Gullibility was just announced.
Oh, yeah?
And this guy, Paul Marsters, he's a member of the True Paranormal Events UK organization. He's this year's recipient because of his research into Ouija boards being doorways for demons and evil spirits to be released upon the planet.
That's a new thing I have never heard of a million times before.
All right, I lied just there. There's not a Nobel Prize for gullibility, but all of you, those who did think that. It is a real news story, though. It's making, you know, it makes the tabloid rounds, and then everyone picks it up, and before you know it, it becomes a piece of clickbait somewhere, and I had to click on it because it said Ouija board, because that's what I do. They know my weaknesses. And I'm sure this news item has something to do with the upcoming Halloween, but I'll avoid speculation on such obvious clickbait techniques used habitually by digital media. But here is the headline so you can judge for yourself. Ghost hunter horrified that Poundland is selling Ouija boards for Halloween.
Poundland?
Yeah, so that's the first thing, Poundland. So in the United States, we have something called the dollar store. So, of course, in the UK, you have Poundland. In Germany,
it was
you had
like a cat house.
Right. Yeah.
At first, I thought it was a place in England, frankly. I'm like, I've never heard of that before. Okay.
That's funny. Poundland. I knew exactly what it was the moment you said it.
In Germany, they have the Marx Hut, and in France, they have the Frank Chateau.
So, well, they so used to that. Before they went to the EU.
The Euro.
They report that this particular chap, Paul Marsters, he was horrified that these stores would sell a Ouija board. They quoted him using the word gobsmacked, one of my favorite words, actually. But why is he so upset? I mean, you know, what's the big deal here? Well,
to get attention during the Halloween season.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Ouija boards, when used by amateurs, don't you know, can possibly release these demons into the material world.
Yeah, leave it to the professionals.
I'm just going to read you some quotes that he said because it's kind of worthy of hearing it straight from his mouth, basically. He says, Ouija boards are most certainly not a toy and should not be available for kids to buy in pound shops for Halloween.
They actually even are literally toys.
Yeah, even though they're made by, like, what, Hasbro
exactly,
or something?
Exactly, right. Yeah, that's exactly right. They've been so for how many decades now, these things out. You see, these people are not trained how to use them. And it doesn't matter the material they're made of, plastic or wood. If the planchette spells the word Zeus, it is a demon trying to come through and should not even say the name, never mind continuing to communicate with it. I love that because no matter what you spell, that's a demon. you know, mm-hmm. you could spell like JQZL. Demon. Don't say
Evan,
the name.
Evan, you feel that cold? That's ghost cold.
Yeah, I thought so. Ooh, I'm frightened. I'm horrified, in fact. Horrified. He said that all hell could break loose if the demon attached itself to anyone and followed them around. Nasty spirits can scratch and attack people and should not be messed with. People could get seriously hurt. So I was gobsmacked when I saw that Poundland were selling these Ouija boards and was profoundly shocked and just fuming, really. And they spoke to us, so they contacted the stores, or representatives from the stores. And, you know, he didn't really have much to say about
except
it.
Except get a life.
Other than, you know, they've pretty much sold out of all their inventory of these things because it's very, very popular. But the fellow goes on to say, he said that we, meaning him and his paranormal group, they won't even touch Ouija boards. We only have mediums do it who are trained because they're too dangerous. And you don't know what will entail using them. And you don't know what it takes to use them, basically. And we only use glasswork to communicate with spirits. Everyone in the paranormal spirit field is angered by this. The risks of untrained people using Ouija boards is unimaginable.
Untrained.
So it's ludicrous. I mean, you have to wonder if this person is serious.
I know, like untrained in how to slowly move it so it seems like a ghost is doing, but really it's you.
That's all right. And I know we've talked about this on the show before, but since it's brought up in this news item, we'll mention it again. Our good old friend, the ideomotor effect, is at work here. Subtle, unconscious, muscular movements people make whenever they're doing things like swinging little pendulums or putting their hands on planchettes on Ouija boards and moving them around. And this has been known for a very long time, basically in the 1800s. This ideomotor action was first identified. It explains dowsing. It explains a whole bunch of things. We've talked about it in the context of facilitated communication, in which allegedly people can aid those with communication impairments, really nefarious use of it, but not realizing exactly what it is going on. We can be fooled by our senses, and we can attribute all kinds of things to things that seem improbable or impossible. And, you know, the ideomotor effect is an example of why we should be using objective scientific testing rather than relying on subjective personal experience to figure out what's real and what's not. So a good example, a good reminder. And, of course, we get to talk a little bit about Halloween, so that's not a bad thing.
Yeah. Do you guys remember when we tested that Ouija board couple?
Never absolutely, for the James Randi $1 million challenge, the preliminary test.
Well, go ahead, tell us what happened, Steve.
Well, it was a husband and wife team, and their second claim was that they could operate a Ouija board. And so we tested them. We got a Ouija board. And so our one scientific control was that we blindfolded them, and we adequately blindfolded them because we know how people could cheat with blindfolds. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is that the wife came to the session with a splint on one of her fingers that apparently she had just sprained and was concerned that this was going to affect her Ouija board skills.
Sure, a built-in excuse, essentially.
She came with a pre-excuse. And so they were unable to even get the planchette on a letter. They were unable to keep it on the board.
What?
Well, blindfolded, they have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, that's true. It's like pin the tail on the donkey.
Yeah, you couldn't even get it on a letter. Even worse than that. My sense was the husband believed and the wife was the one who was moving the planchette. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't think that she was surprised for a second that they completely failed, whereas he seemed a little flummoxed. Then they were going to get retested after her finger healed. Never heard from them again. But
wow, so she might have been like just fully scamming her own husband that whole
time. That's
horrible.
Right. That's what I think.
Right. Well, we've actually seen that before, in which there are either husband-wife teams or confederates. One person who kind of really is sold that something is happening here, yet the other person is, you know, the clever one, the con, as it were.
Right.
You know,
Jay?
Remember DeHartma,
right.
Steve?
Yeah, yeah.
The woman who was supposedly channeling the
Nepalese spirit
for the Nepalese
who couldn't
spirit.
Nepalese. Yeah,
she had a little, you know, group of a couple people who were very fascinated by her abilities, but she herself, I don't know, she, you know,
Nah. she knew she was full of it. She was performing.
Right. Wow. But they were buying into it. So we've seen that kind of relationship.
That's like, but that was again, I know I've said this story before, but it just is so funny. Because like Evan and I are getting ready to investigate this channeler who's channeling a 700-year-old Nepalese spirit. So literally we're like, okay, so we need to record her and I need to find somebody at Yale who can interpret the ancient Nepalese and tell me if it's appropriate to 700 years ago or if they're speaking modern Nepalese. The spirit didn't even speak Nepalese. He was able to say namaste. That was it. Otherwise, he spoke English in a cheesy Indian accent.
Oh, no.
But would say namaste. That was it.
He spoke yoga.
He spoke yoga. It's horrible.
One of our questions we specifically asked, is there any other word in Nepalese that you can speak?
No.
No. That was the answer. No.
I mean, and the thing that blows my mind is, and that's good enough for some people.
I know.
Right. That is impressive to say.
Well, how come you speak English and not Nepalese? Because you speak the language of the person who's channeling you. Then why do you have the accent?
Because it sounds good.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't try to make sense of it. It was hilarious.
It was
right.
Wild. Yep.
Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time.
All right, guys. Last week, I played this noisy. All right, what was that?
Cow anybody? Orgasm.
That was some kind of animalcule. I think that's an animal.
Animalcule.
Kara?
That's a great word.
What do you say, Kara?
A demon. I've been watching a lot of What We Do in the Shadows.
She's right. The show's over. Good job.
Well done. She used her Ouija
great.
Board.
Great. I love that show, Kara.
Yeah, it was so good.
So a listener named Casey Doro wrote in and said, "Hey, Jay, I think the noise from episode 795 is a rubber squeaky chicken with the squeaker placed at the end of a PC pipe, PVC pipe.
That's creative.
Damn, that is awesome. I got to do that now. How do you get the squeaky chicken throat thing? How do you get one of those other than buying the chicken? I got to
hear
that.
You got to just buy the chicken.
Okay.
Yeah.
Next one, my Roman warrior, Visto Tutti. I'm going to meet that guy someday, and we're going to laugh at each other. He wrote in, "This week's noisy sounds to me like a possum threat call, but so deep sounding it would have to be a man-eating sized possum, so I'm guessing it's a caribou." not a horrible guess, by the way, but it's not caribou.
It's not a possum.
That's a term of endearment for Kara.
Another listener named Wesley Sullivan. Is it Wesley or Wesley?
I don't think that matters. I think Wesley and Wesley are interchangeable. No?
I go with Jean-Luc Picard's pronunciation. Wesley.
Well, Wesley has won.
Yeah.
Oh.
Although he wasn't completely specific. He said, "I used to hunt with my dad. That's a deer call. Love the show. Thank you." Mm. And then he signed it Owen. Okay, so his name is Owen, but he signed it with, that's probably his middle name. He goes by his middle name. Got it. Okay, figured it out. Wesley Owen Sullivan. Okay. It is a deer. It is a deer. So a listener named Cody Grills wrote in and said, "Jay, that's the mating call or bellow of a red deer buck in Italy's Abruzzo National Park for obvious reasons. The months of September and October are also known as roaring season when red deer are common." So that's a red deer. I did a little research and there are other kinds of deer out there. And
you thought there was only one kind of deer?
Well,
red deer.
I knew that there was other kinds of deer.
Bambius maximus.
I knew there were other kinds of deer. I just didn't know because this one, there was a video. So I'm looking at it and I'm like, well, his hair's kind of red, but I wasn't 100% sure it was a red deer. So I just thought, let me look up all the different kinds of deer that there are.
God,
and there's lots
so
of different
deer.
Kinds of deer.
Yes.
I have a red deer antler.
Yeah, there are 43 species in the deer family. And caribou are deer. Caribou are reindeer. That's the same animal.
Yep.
And that's just deer, not antelope?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And, you know, deer, as much as we consider them cute and little or whatever, they're not, you know, they have weapons attached to their head.
There's a fanged deer. Yeah.
There is a fanged deer. That one's crazy looking. But he's small, though, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So that was a great, I really enjoyed that. It was a really cool, interesting animal noise. So thank you for sending that in, Cody. And good guessing, everyone. There was lots of fun, absurd guesses that you didn't get to read because I always get a ton of answers. But let's move on to this week's noisy. This is a noisy sent in by Mariana, and she said the J in her name is silent, and if she didn't tell me, I would have said Mary Jana. So Mariana Bankovic, this is a really, really cool sound. Check this out. All right, so before you jump off to guessing, listeners of the SGU, before you run to guess, listen to it again and try to hear the different things that you're hearing, because there's more than just one or two sounds in there. And start with that. This one I think is going to be difficult, but if you think you know what it is, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Yeah, there were some sounds in there. That could be a subtle one. So, Jay, I have an announcement.
Go ahead, Steve.
This is a save the date announcement.
Ooh.
And that save the date announcement is for January 23rd.
Yes.
Saturday, January 23rd.
It's 12 hours of your life, Bob.
12 hour show. Now, we haven't locked in a time yet. We're thinking 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern time, but that's penciled in. But
right,
the January
I complained. 23rd,
yeah, that's why. We're still negotiating the exact time. But it's going to be on January 23rd, Saturday, January 23rd, 12 hours of SGU. Mark your calendar, save the date. We're planning it. This is a thank you to all of our listeners, but especially our members and our patrons, because we hit our goal of 4,000 patrons. In fact, Jay, I would think it's safe to say that we blew through the 4,000.
Wow.
Yeah, so as we record, we're at 4,182.
Yeah. Whoa.
Yeah. And again, guys, thank you so much for your support. I mean, when we told you a couple of months ago, a month and a half ago, you know, that we were having financial problems due to COVID, you guys jumped to help, and we really, really appreciate
it. Really appreciate it. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, we did one ad for the show tonight. That's the first ad we've done in a very long time. Like, right? We're still not out of the woods.
Basically have the contracts that we did at the beginning of the year, but we're not getting any new ones.
Yeah.
All right. So we have a couple of corrections this week. One for Jay, one for Evan. Evan, we'll start with you. This one comes from Aaron, although we got a couple of people pointed this out. Aaron writes, longtime fan and native German speaker here. I wanted to comment on something Evan said in episode 795 Science or Fiction segment when discussing the item about letter redundancy in the English alphabet. Evan mentioned somewhere that there are only 25 letters in the German alphabet. That's not true, sir!
Liar!
We pretty much have the same 26-letter alphabet that the English language has. If at all, we have three more letters. The umlaut, which are basically variations of A, O, and U, by putting two dots on top of them. This changes the way they are pronounced. But in school, I remember learning about there being 26 letters only. Surely it's not 25. However, Evan, explain yourself.
Oh, well, so a subtle comment during the science or fiction Think Out Loud turned into a national controversy about the German alphabet. I misremembered, of course. you know, you get something happens a long time ago and you think you remember it, but then you go to recall it and it comes up like only 87% of the way true. Here's what happened. I'd taken a few years of German in high school, and I was had a German to English dictionary that was issued, and I used it the entire time. While going through the dictionary, I, you know, went through all the letters, but I found that there was no entries in there for words that began with the letter Y. And I specifically remember having a conversation, not the exact contents of the conversation, unfortunately, but a conversation with my teacher about that. And boy, I wish I could remember exactly why, huh? That was the case, but it just stood out to me. It was so odd. So that thing burned into my brain, and I store it away, and then 30 whatever years later it comes up. I have to recall it because I'm trying to think about letters specific for this question in science or fiction, and I'm trying to make a correlation there. So I kind of just quickly remembered it, but not to the detail. After I have to kind of go back and think about it a little more, it was words that began with Y in this particular dictionary. And then it come to find out that there are actually some words that do begin with Y, not a lot, not a plethora, but it is used. There are words, mostly, I think, proper names that will begin with Y in some cases, but the letter J is the Y, right? Ya, mm-hmm. J-A. So there is, right? So whenever you hear the Y sounding letter, the vast majority of the time in German, it's the letter J. So that was my confusion. And in just riffing about, you know, thinking out loud about the question, that's what came out of my mouth. And I completely retract it and apologize to alphabetists everywhere.
Thank you. All right. Next one is for Jay. Again, we got a few emails on this, but this particular email comes from Richard in Virginia, who writes, two episodes ago, Jay spoke about coal plants being able to turn on with a flick of a switch. This is not the case. They have to heat up steam to a superheated state, which is used in a heat exchange system. It can take hours, if not days, for a coal plant to go from cold iron to being operational. I was on an old Navy ship which used oil-fired boilers, and it would take us hours to bring them up to steam.
Yep.
Jay, what have you got to say for yourself?
He's completely right. This is one of those moments where, you know, I had a piece of information in my head. I hadn't challenged it because I just didn't think it needed to be challenged. I had somehow assumed, I think a lot of people like fell into this category, just assumed that we use coal-fired plants for on-the-spot electricity demand. So here is the actual science. This is called dispatchable generation. And this refers to a source of electricity that can be used on demand, and it's quote-unquote dispatched at the request of the power grid operators or according to market needs. So what is examples of dispatchable generation? What do they use for that? So they're basically saying there's two forms of dispatchable plants, hydroelectric and natural gas. Hydroelectric can create electricity 16 seconds after they turn it on, which is amazing because it's just the energy is there, right? The water hits the turbines are making electricity. Natural gas could be anytime past 15 minutes. Coal, on the other hand, and my God, these numbers are crazy, but coal can take hours, many, many, many hours for it to get up to speed in order where it's creating the peak, I guess the peak amount that it could hit. So they would not use a coal plant for an emergency, you know, if you need electricity immediately.
Yeah, it looks like it peaks in about 9 hours, depending on the generation, the exact design of the plant. But yeah, not that. But it's generating some electricity before that. But I mean,
yeah, it just ramps up though. But so nuclear plants and coal are designed to run as something called a baseload power plant, which is essentially like the daily use. It's predictable. They know at 5 o'clock when everyone leaves work that demand is going to go up or down or whatever happens. And they have these plants scheduled and they're on when they need them. And they're probably on in a very regular cycle because it's like, again, this is all the predictable required, use of electricity that they know.
Yeah, the paper I was looking at, Jay, for that, like for most coal plants, they'll turn on twice a year. You know, they basically, once they're going, they just keep leaving going.
Yeah. Yeah. It's expensive to turn them on and off. And, you know, I'm sure that, you know, just keeping those plants up and running, even if they're not on, you know, if it's like a backup emergency type of thing, it's incredibly expensive. So the renewables too, again, real quick, just to give you like more information that I found. Wind and solar, you know, this is not dispatchable generation. You know, we would need batteries in order to have that.
Or overproduction. The other way to do that is just have so much of it that like the wind is blowing somewhere, you know, and you're just sharing it over a wide area. But that becomes less and less efficient as you try to produce, you know, a higher and higher percentage of your power by overproducing intermittent sources. Storing the energy somewhere is a much better way to go.
So as a quick lesson, a quick skeptical lesson, if you thought the way that I did before you heard this information, if you thought that coal plants were the plants that they would turn on quickly to generate electricity under, you know, I wouldn't say an emergency, but under a high demand situation, then take a moment to be humbled, right?
So what I found, Jay, is that if I have a piece of information in my head, if I didn't verify or confirm that information fairly recently, it's suspect. I might think I know something, but if I haven't checked it recently, that my memory might have drifted or it might just be obsolete. Or I, whatever. Just memories are just that fallible. So I know it's hard because we go off script so much. We're talking about so much stuff, but we really do have to check ourselves on everything. You know, that's right. Like when you're publishing in the peer reviewed literature, this is partly why it's so hard and tedious. Like you literally have to verify every single fact that you state. And also good journalism, too. You have to go through there and verify every single factual claim that you make, because you may think you know things, but they're just not true for whatever reason. Okay, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake-a-rooney, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Three regular news items this week. It's still hard. Still, like half the news items are about COVID-19.
Oh, boy.
It's amazing. Okay, here we go. You guys ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right, item number one. An extensive review of fossil evidence finds that when North and South America became connected by a land bridge, migrations of mammals occurred in both directions, but South American species experienced a much higher extinction rate. That land bridge, of course, being Panama. Item number two, a study of nursing home residents finds that tuned lighting, brighter hallway lighting during the day and dimmer at night, resulted in a halving of nighttime sleep disturbance events over traditional static lighting. And item number three, a new study finds that dog brains have a similar response to faces as do humans and other primates. Evan, go first.
Let's see. May I take these in reverse order, please?
Do whatever pleases you, Evan.
Excellent. I'll start with the fourth one. All right. Third, a new study finds that dog brains have a similar response to faces as do humans and other primates. I'm tempted to say this one is science because I've actually read some articles, not very recently, but within the last year or two, about dog brains and faces and eye contact and sort of this interaction, at least between humans and dogs, and it's more sophisticated than researchers had either previously thought or the new evidence came about. So I wouldn't be surprised at this one. So that's why I think it's science. Then the second one, the middle one, nursing home residents find that tuned lighting resulted in halving of nighttime sleep disturbance events over traditional static lighting. Well, this could go either way. This one's kind of a real 50-50 one, isn't it? Because it either did or it didn't. So that one's definitely possible to be either. And the first one about the fossil evidence, North and South America, when they were connected, or still are connected, but the big land bridge and the migration of mammals, South American species experienced a much higher extinction rate. Why would the South American species experience a much higher extinction rate? A South American species, Steve, that started in South America and migrated north? Is that what I'm reading here?
So there's species that existed in South America prior to the land bridge and species that existed in North America prior to the land bridge. And then you could look at any point after the land bridge and say, all right, how many species in South America have ancestors that are from North America and vice versa.
I don't know why they would experience a much higher extinction rate. That's a tough one. And with fossil evidence, I mean, we're going back quite a ways. It would help if I kind of knew maybe around when that bridge started to occur, but I don't. So I don't know about that one, which means I guess that's the one I'll go with as the fiction. I have a feeling that
3 million years ago, by the way.
3 million? Okay. Yeah, I think the nursing home one will be science because I'm not even sure that would have been worthy of a news item if it wasn't the case. Why would it be reported? So I think by process elimination, the South American species one is going to be the fiction.
Okay. Kara?
Okay. North and South America became connected, or when they became connected, migrations occurred in both directions, but South American species experienced much higher extinction rate. I don't know why that would be, but I could see it happening. I mean, they're two massive land masses. So just because they could migrate a across this tiny peninsula doesn't mean that they wouldn't have like incredibly different evolutionary rates based on different pressures. So like maybe there was, you know, more climate change, or there was like less to eat, or, you know, whatever. So I could see that being science. The nursing home one, I think, was probably definitely science. I've actually seen some studies about changing lighting to like a red hue at night and it having like a massive effect on your ability to sleep. So I don't see why that one would be a problem to induce melatonin earlier. And then dog brains having a similar response to faces, as do humans and other chimps or other primates. I also don't see this one being a problem, but I guess it sticks out to me the most just because maybe their response is not as similar as we want it to be. Like, it's a dog-like response, but humans and other primates are very similar, you know, organisms. So we probably have much more capability to distinguish emotion, for example, than a dog. Like, we wish that they were probably better at it, but my guess is going to be that their processing isn't quite as acute as ours. So I'll say that one's a fiction.
Okay, Bob.
All right. So the North and South America land bridge. Yeah, there's so many possibilities as to why the South American species had a higher extinction rate. You know, there's just a lot of different things. And Kara mentioned a few of them that make that a possibility. The third one, the dog brains. And yeah, I totally buy that they have a similar response, not, you know, identical, but similar response. I think they're generally advantageous for them to be able to read people's faces. It wouldn't surprise me if it were a similar response, much higher than, say, a cat. Like, a cat gives a shit what your face is doing. the second one that I have trouble with this one, and what my problem with the lighting is that it's just the hallway. If you told me that it was in their room, I probably would have bought it. But in the hallway, compare the room, the time that they spend in the hallway at night compared to the time they spend like in non-hallways, or especially their room. I think that's a huge difference. So I think, you know, a 5 or 10%, you know, change in the light for an area of the place where they live that, you know, that they don't spend a lot of time in, I don't think that's going to make a lot of difference. So I'll say that's fiction.
Oh, boy.
All right. So, Jay, last week you had a solo win.
Yes.
This week, they're spread out. No solo win for you, but who are you going to back up here? One, two, or three?
Very quickly, the first one about North and South America. So if I'm hearing this correctly, the creatures that came from South America who went north died off more than the North American creatures going south. I think, you know, it could be a weather thing. I don't know. But that seems perfectly reasonable to me. Nursing home, yeah, tuned lighting, I totally agree. I think it works. I've had, you know, many doctors tell me lower the lights, you know, slowly at night, you know, relax, all that. So I think that's connected. I agree with
humbug.
I agree with Kara, the dog brain, dogs not being able to, or they don't have the same face response as humans. I totally agree with that. Because first of all, the one thing that Kara said, like about they're not needing to see facial expressions like we do. You know, they don't, you know, dogs developed the ability to use their eyebrows probably because of their interaction with humans. That's a late developing trait, right? You know, there's not much, facial features going on with a dog that's expressive. So I totally agree. It makes perfect sense that that one is the fiction.
Mm.
Okay. So I guess we'll take these in order. An extensive review of fossil evidence finds that when North and South America became connected by a land bridge, migrations of mammals occurred in both directions, but South American species experienced a higher extinction rate. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is...
Say it.
Science. Yeah, science. So the question was, did more species from the north migrate south than the other way around? That's one possibility they could have found. Or was there higher extinction among the South American species? And what they found was that there was definitely a higher rate of extinction. And it wasn't just the extinction rate of South American mammals that went north. It was South American species in South America were going extinct. So there were fewer of them to migrate. Right?
Right.
And this paper didn't explore the question of why that's the case. It just looked at the fossil evidence to show that it was the case. But the speculation is, the hypothesis is that North American predators were just better than South American predators, that the North American predators had better adaptations. They were just more dangerous. And they outcompeted the South American predators. They created a much more hostile environment for South American species. They were basically like invasive species, right? And the South American species couldn't compete. So
now, Steve, terror birds migrated north, right?
I don't know. Did they?
Yes, I will say yes, they did. I remember reading that they migrated north and they lived in North America for like a couple million years. That's what my memory's telling me. So can you confirm or deny it?
Titanus, a North American terror bird, migrated from South America. You're correct.
How awesome is that?
Yeah. Let's go to number two. A study of nursing home residents finds that tuned lighting, brighter hallway lighting during the day and dimmer at night, resulted in a halving of nighttime sleep disturbance events over traditional static lighting. Bob, you think this one is a fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
The dog one.
Oh, no. No way, man. There's no way. Jay. I live with an old lady. There's no way cutting down the light in the hallway that she spends 10% of her time in, or 5, is going to cut her sleep disturbances in half.
Every time you wake up to pee, every time you wake up, you can't go back to sleep right away. But if the light is dim and red, you'll be able to go back to sleep pretty instantly.
Yeah, also, you're turning down those lights before they go to sleep. Right.
It's like wind down time.
How much time do you spend in the hallway?
It's about creating an environment that mimics, you know, the day night cycle. It's very important. And we've lost that. You know, if you live, especially think about it, you know, if you're like a nursing home, like the hallway has static, you know, lighting that's the same 24/7.
Fluorescent lighting.
Fluorescent lighting. These were all LED lights, but the LEDs were made to mimic sort of static fluorescent lighting in that condition, or they had the tuned lighting where it would become brighter. Brighter than, that's the other thing. It was not only bright, it was brighter than normal during the day and then dimmer than normal at night. Mm.
Yeah.
And so getting like daylight during the day and then low light at night is really helpful to our circadian rhythm.
And the color temperature too.
Did you ever visit either of your grandmas in their nursing home? I did. They were never in the hallway. They were in their room. In their goddamn rooms.
Yeah, but light comes
that light
in from
leaks
the hallway
in.
Too. Yeah, it leaks in.
Yeah. What,
under the door?
Mm-hmm. Oh, those doors usually have windows in them.
Bob, remember I was talking about skeptical humility?
Yeah. And this is something, you know, I know it sounds silly, but if you're somebody who's on your computer a lot, there are actually really good evidence-based programs. I use one called Flux. And what it does is it knows what time I go to sleep every night, and it starts to slowly change the color temperature of my screen. And sometimes I don't notice it until it's happened, where I'm like, oh, it's late, I need to go to bed. And I don't realize, but my screen is like blood red and dark.
Yeah.
Because I've been on it so late. And it really does help me transition. Yeah.
Yeah, my cell phone screen has a night mode as well.
Yeah. In this study, the residents with the static lighting had 3.6 nighttime sleep disturbances per night on average, and the compared to 1.8, so it's exactly
half.
The tuned lighting.
Cool.
Yeah. So, no, I find that totally believable. And that's a lot of evidence to show that lighting is critical. I hear what you're saying, Bob, but yeah, that's the way it is. But also, the other thing is, a lot of these patients were demented, 35 out of 63. Mm-hmm. And maybe
so they were sleeping in the hallway? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying maybe the effect might be greater on a brain that's diseased, you know, than one that's healthy. So it'd be interesting to replicate this in a more healthy population. But in any case, that's totally believable. Which means that a new study finds that dog brains have a similar response to faces as do humans and other primates is the fiction. Jay and Carrie, you are correct, because dogs are not primates. Now, there was two comparisons that they were making. Humans and other primates, the visual part of their brain, because we have a face area, right? We have a face, dedicated face area.
Fusiform gyrus.
Of our brain. And it reacts more, our brain in general, and the visual part of our brain reacts more when we see a member of our own species versus a member of another species. and it reacts more when we see a face than when we see an otherwise equivalent non-face stimulus. And the, what they used as their control was the back of the head, right? So you have a picture of the back of someone's head versus their face. The brain showed more activity to the face than the back of the head, more activity to a human than to a dog picture. Dog brains, they don't have a fusiform gyrus, right? They don't have a face area. But also, while their brains did react more to dogs over non-dogs, they did not react more to faces over non-faces. Aww. And so they don't have that same preference for faces that primates do.
That's kind of sad.
Yeah, so it was different.
We want to think that it's...
Yeah, I know. That's why I thought this would be a perfect science because, I mean, a perfect fiction because you guys want to believe that this is true.
My dog loved my face.
That's right. My dog knows my face.
He licked it enough. She licked it enough. Both of them.
Yeah. I didn't know if anybody was going to bring up the fact that dogs may be more olfactory than visual.
Right. Because we know they don't pass the mirror test, but there have been newer versions that, you know, researchers are saying maybe we need like an olfactory mirror test for dogs.
Smell test. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Mm. All right. Good job, Jay and Kara. I like it when you guys all spread out. It means I balanced them well.
Yes.
Yeah, good job, Steve. You did.
All right, Evan, quote.
In any big science enterprise like planetary exploration, where you must work in big teams of similarly driven people, it is important to also know how to work alongside others, even when they may be your fiercest competitors. And that was said by Carolyn Porco.
Yeah, Carolyn, excellent science communicator.
Yeah, we love Carolyn. She, of course, of the famous for of the Cassini probe and Enceladus and all the research that's gone into probing our solar system. She's tremendous and a great communicator.
Yeah. Yeah, it just shows how, you know, collaborative science is, that even when you're competitors, you're working together. You know, there is that always that balance, I find, you know, among researchers that, yeah, absolutely, if you're a successful researcher, you have a competitive angle to what you're doing. You want to get your paper out first, et cetera. But at the same time, it has to be cooperative, collaborative. And in fact, you know, I think universities are specifically rewarding collaborative research more now just because it's so important. So yeah, it's a good quote.
Yeah. And Nobel Prizes reflect that as well, I think.
Yep. All right. Thank you guys all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
We'll see you at the Friday live stream. We'll see you on January 23rd at the 12-hour show.
Oh, boy.
Send in your ideas if there's things that you want to see or hear on that show.
Keep it tasteful.
Yep. Well, we're looking forward to that. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.